It's working now. Nothing will work without these, excuse me. Mr. President, honoured guests and old Farnhamians. Now, I've attended many of these functions and I've always been impressed by the eloquence of the speakers, luminaries who praise the school fulsomely and with great affection. When it comes to Farnham Grammar School, they got it. Oh, if by the way I lapse occasionally and say Farnham Golf Club, please forgive me, but I'm
you've adapted it, have you?
Their lives were enriched by being there, and the school was obviously enriched by their presence. Some of us, however, made little impression on the cultural and educational experience that was Farnham Grammar School. So I'm honoured and thrilled to be able to stand here today and be allowed to put in a word for the compliant underachiever. See a few kindred spirits here. Now, in my experience, there are two main areas of underachievement, that is sporting and academic. And I have excelled in both. I shall begin with sport. To paint a full picture, I must give you some significant background information. I had a brother, Geoffrey, who excelled at every sport on the planet. He was school team captain in football, cricket, swimming, athletics. If there'd been a Tiddlywink team, he would have captained them. But not at Farnham Grammar School, which was just as well because I was always being compared to him at East Street. Words like, "Are you Geoffrey's brother?" "Yes." "You're not much like him, are you?" It comes a shock to parents today, but in school holidays, my mother would grab us both by the scruff of the neck and throw us out the back door and say, "I do not want you under my feet through the holidays. Get out and play, and make sure you're back in time for lunch." And to my brother, she would say, "And take him with you." So both reluctantly, we would trudge up to Farnham Park, me behind him, and if he had to, he would let me play football, usually in goal, where he and his much older friends used to hammer the ball at me as hard as they could. Didn't do much for my self-esteem, but I suppose it did harden me up a little bit. So, of all the sporting opportunities at school where I thought I might be able to emulate my brother, my best chance was with football. If you're not interested in football, you have my permission to sleep for a moment, but just snore quietly. The first real issue was the Morley House football team selection. I, being right-footed, decided I would establish myself somewhere over on the right hand of the field, only to be told in no uncertain terms that these positions were already taken, go and find somewhere else. The only hole I could find on the pitch was roughly in the left half position, but this was okay with me because that meant the number 6 shirt, which was to be immortalised by the sainted Bobby Moore. Now this was a period when football was undergoing transition. Alf Ramsey had recently been appointed as the England manager, and he was doing away with the old W formation, and halfbacks were being morphed into midfielders. I like to think I was in the vanguard of this revolution. I couldn't tackle, therefore I was not the defensive midfielder. I was easily dispossessed, therefore I was not the holding midfielder. Therefore, by default, I became the creative midfielder. Nobody knew what a creative midfielder was supposed to do, but I discovered that I could float around all day pretending to be useful, and if I got the ball, I'd pass it to somebody else. I avoided the usual melee in the penalty area by hovering just outside, and sure enough, the ball eventually came loose, and I ran onto it and dispatched it into the goal with my right foot. This was considered very clever and cemented my place in the team. As an aside, Martin Peters scored a very similar goal in the World Cup. It was said he ghosted into the box. He ghosted into the box. I preceded him as the original invisible creative midfield ghost. Very proud of that. Another occasion. This was during games. We used to play colours, do you remember colours, shirts and white shirts, and I was on the colours. I quote from the match report. Roger Jones received the ball on the right wing and set off at pace. Creative midfielder Golding, recognising the opportunity, eased his way effortlessly past the right back, just as Jones reached the goal line and crossed the ball with pinpoint accuracy. Golding met it with a powerful header that burst the net before the keeper could even react. Fantastic. Thus would have read the match report had I written it. The untold story reveals a right back stood at the corner of the penalty area shivering with cold with his hands tucked into his shorts. The hapless keeper was Robert Ponick, who treated athletic pursuits with absolute disdain. And at the time I scored, as I recall, he was leaning against the goalpost reading a book. Anyway, sufficiently impressed the referee and master in charge, Peter Darby, who recommended me for what I believe was the second 11. That was the pinnacle of my career. Now, we always had a master as a referee, do you remember that? And they loved it. It got them out of the common room and the classroom, I suppose. But I think the big thing was it was an opportunity for them to exercise their sardonic gifts. Casing points at my expense. Rather large centre-half on the opposing team lost control of the ball, let it get away from him, and I must have been established in the team for a while because I foolishly allowed myself to believe in a moment of overconfidence that I could steal the ball from him. It did not go well. We both ended up in a heap on the ground, my elbow in his throat and my knee in his groin. He was not pleased. He picked himself up and me with him, shook me by the throat and used a stream of explicit invectives, best way I can put it. There were some very rude words, but the bottom line was that if I ever got anywhere near him again, he was going to break my king neck. And he said this right in front of the referee stroke master. So I turned to him and I said, "Did you hear that, sir?" He said, "Yes, I did." I said, "What are you going to do about it then?" He said, "Nothing." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, Golding, I was under the impression he was talking to you." So much for football. Briefly move on to school cross country. Now that course gradually got longer as you got older. In fact, in the fifth and sixth forms, it virtually went into the next county. But it always went through. It always went through the curiously named Paradise Woods. I never saw anything particularly paradisic about that. And of course, if like me, you weren't a very good cross country runner, you went out through Paradise Woods and you came back through Paradise Woods. So you could unfortunately find the leaders coming back as you were still going out. That could be very depressing. But I recall a house in Little Austin's Road. It had a model railway in the front garden that went all the way around the lawn. Some people nodding may remember that, but it's a detail that might have been missed by the more athletic among you because you'd have been running. But if likely you were walking around the course, you had more time to take these things in. I think we'll leave sport behind. My primary school, East Street, didn't send many pupils to Farming Ground School, so I didn't actually know many people there before I started. Nevertheless, there was a rumour mill and some rumours crept out. So, with some trepidation, I spent the first day in the first form worried about being de-bagged and having my trousers run up the flagpole. Luckily, that rumour was misplaced. Not so the rumours about the mad chemistry teacher. He was reputed to shout at everybody and he'd lock you in the fume cupboard if you stepped out of line. I didn't know what a fume cupboard was. He handed up an entirely wrong image. My first encounter, though, with Mr. Evans came not in school, but at South Street traffic lights in the middle of Farnham. I was on my bike on the way home with my school cap on my head and my satchel over my back, waiting to turn right, and beside me arrived a motorcycle. And beneath the helmet and goggles, I recognised Mr. Evans. "Hello, sir," I said. His reply was, and I'll never forget this, Get out of the way, you idiot. The alleged highlight of the first year was the half term of English lessons with George Baxter. This actually was the platform for him to deliver the facts of life. Huge anticipation surrounded this. Up to then, my sex education consisted of the ladies' underwear pages of the Gamage's catalogue. Or a shared and much-thumbed copy of Health and Efficiency. In the event, the facts of life was a bit of a disappointment, and George was a great man, wonderful teacher, but not much of an artist. And his representation of the male member on the blackboard, I guarantee, had every boy in the class going, "What?" It must have been during that hiatus that I misheard him and spent the first week thinking that the proper term for it was peanuts. The highlight of my second year, was the TB jab. This was preceded by weeks of being wound up by the older boys. It's got a needle a foot long, with a hook at the end. You get a nasty scab on your arm. If you knock it off, your arm goes black and drops off. Then you die. Some of the class stayed away that day, but I tell you, that plaster was a badge of courage. In the third year, we were put into sets with pupils from 3P. I hadn't seen them for 2 years. And we were also divided, for some obscure reason, between Latin and biology. I was chosen for Latin, a mystery that remains to this day. The whole issue made worse by the third year Wednesday afternoon timetable, which read Latin, RI, Latin. Whoever came up with that timetable deserved a good slapping in, I think. Not helped by, on one occasion, I casually observed one of my fellow pupils, Graham Hurry, being carried unconscious from the biology lab by 4 boys, one on each limb. Unfortunately, they managed to drop him in the corridor outside the gym, at which point he woke up and was promptly sick on the floor. Apparently, he fainted during a demonstration of the dissection of a frog. Mr. Gavacol had detailed 4 lads to take him outside for fresh air. This whole episode seemed much more interesting and exciting to me than Latin, R.I., bloody Latin. Anyway, at length, in the fifth form, we came to the Latin O-level mock. Foregone conclusion, I was going to duff it. The first part of the exam was always translation of a well-known passage. So I decided to learn, off by heart, the first paragraph of Caesar's Gallic Wars, as it was a bit of a banker, and I hoped it would come up. It duly did, and got me 20 of my 25%. We normally did exams in the school hall or the gym, but for some reason, they must have been occupied or something, we would have to trudge up to the church at St. Thomas on the Bourne, lovely church, and they'd set it up with desks and tables and chairs for us. Now, it's a lovely church, but wherever you are, 2 hours of despair does not pass quickly. And at the end, Don Nicholson kindly asked me how I thought I'd got on. I said, "Do you see the organ at the front of that church then?" He said he did. I said, "There's 132 pipes on that organ." I once got 100% in an arithmetic exam. I alone amongst the class had worked out how long it took to empty the bath. You remember that question? Yeah. This was before metric units, so I had to grapple with pi, gallons and square inches. And I managed to get it right. I've now learnt that the BBC has moved even beyond metric and has distilled every measurement down to 6 basic units. In order of size, the first 5 are the London double-decker bus, the Olympic swimming pool, the football pitch, Wembley Stadium, and the Principality of Wales. Yes. The most recent addition is the height of the Shard. Now, it's a bit of a hobby of now, but it irritates me that the BBC thinks the great British public cannot appreciate the size of something unless they use these rather patronising, dumbed-down approximations. And then I sit down to watch one of my favourite shows, Pointless, and I see why they do it. The look of hapless resignation on the face of the contestants when the subject is revealed as geography is all too common. Their confession that they know nothing of geography makes me ask, well, have they never looked at a map or a globe of the world? Are they no interest where they're going on holiday or why it takes 4 hours to get there? Is it really a triumph to trot out the answer as the Central African Republic in the hope it shares a border with Luxembourg? History is the same. Tony Hancock expressed it better than I ever could, and I quote, "Does English mean nothing to them? Have they never heard of Magna Carta? Did she die in vain?" And this leads me to wonder what wonderful teachers like Tony Moore would have made of it. Tony, who passed away recently, I remember took my first ever lesson at Farnham Grammar School in September 1961. I can't remember the exact topic, but I remember the occasion as though it were yesterday and with some affection. And affection sums up my memories of Farnham Grammar School. I was frustrated at times, but probably less so than my teachers, who thought I should have done some better and said so in all my reports. They were dedicated, enthusiastic and encouraging. And after 50 years, I still appreciate the kindness and support of, and it's not an exhaustive list, but amongst others, Harry Beacon, Matt Foster, Jesse James, Derek Friggins, Don Nicholson, Tony Moore, and Stan Owen, who, much to my surprise and delight, remembered me when we met again after many years at my first attendance at this function. So the experience and education I received served me well. And the simple matter of joining the School Aviation Society, newly formed, introduced me to a world of interest that led to a long and fulfilling career in air traffic control. As an aside, I've been asked occasionally, why did I choose air traffic control rather than being a pilot? It's simple. If a pilot screws up, the pilot dies. If an air traffic controller screws up, the pilot dies. I owe a great deal to Farnham Grammar School and was lucky to have been a pupil there.
Brilliant.
I'm sure many of you feel the same way. I therefore invite you all to charge your glasses and join me in a toast.
Is that yours? What's that mean?
Gentlemen, the school.
The school.
The school. The school.